fist that we do, what's paramount and what's necessary is the Maisa HaMitzvah itself. All the proper intentions without the Maisa HaMitzvah are zero. If there's the Maisa HaMitzvah, then the Maisa HaMitzvah can be enhanced infinitely depending on the perspective that we take concerning the mitzvah. Too often we lose sight of the forest for the trees. We can get so caught up in the details, and not to minimize them, Chalila, they're critically important. But we have to at some point remember to take that step back and look at the panorama too. And the creators of our minhagim have struggled mightily to achieve this balance. When we put on tefillin in the morning, there's a whole paragraph before it, which is intended to focus us on what the significance of mitzvah tefillin is. The halacha demands mitzvah shrichas kavona, that we at least take awareness of the fact that we're about to do a mitzvah before we do it. If we take note of the fact that it's a mitzvah, that's also the opportunity to realize that what does it mean, a mitzvah? A mitzvah, the word mitzvah suffers from the fact that in the Yiddish language, in the Hebrew language, it has two different meanings. In the Yiddish language, mitzvah has the connotation of a good deed. As an elderly Rav once told me, if you ask someone for a chesed, so you would say to a mitzvah. Whereas mitzvah in the Hebrew, in the Lashon Kodesh, is a commandment. Very far and distant in its denotation from a good deed. Mandatory and obligatory. The essence of mitzvahs, as defined by the Rambam, is to realize that they are part and parcel of the service of the Rabbeinu Shalom. That's where we begin. But varied mitzvahs also place upon us the obligation to realize what we're striving for with this mitzvah. Hanukkah, the halacha states clearly, is that you have to pursue Menisa, to publicize in this. And it involves the Haidos of the Hallow to give praise to the Rabbeinu Shalom. So that demands that beyond the act of the Hadlaka itself, that we realize exactly what the Nes was, and thereby come to sing the praises of the Rabbeinu Shalom. There's been much discussion and debate over the centuries over which aspect of the history of Hanukkah was the most significant in terms of actually enacting the Yontif itself. There was, on one hand, a war with the forces of Antiochus, and their first significant defeat was suffered during the period of Hanukkah, albeit there was a lengthy history, many years were to follow until they were finally to be driven from Eretz Yisrael altogether. But this was the first significant victory. We secured the Beis HaMikdash, a signal achievement. That's one aspect of Hanukkah. The second aspect of Hanukkah is the Nes of the Menorah. So which one actually is the purpose of the Yontif? And there's been much debated. And which is it to commemorate the Nes of the Neris, or is it to commemorate the victory in the war? The Maharal Prague, in his writings on Masechet Shabbos and Perek Bava Medlikin, is very firmly of the view that Hanukkah is to commemorate the military victory over the forces of Antiochus. And he seems to be borne out by the text of the Al-Anisim. The text of the Al-Anisim talks about the miraculous nature of a military victory, but it does not really mention the miracle of the burning of the oil. It mentions V'edliku neiros b'chashos kachecha. It does not state anything miraculous which took place in that regard. So this seems to bear out the view of the Maromi Prat. But again, this is a much debated subject. But I want to explore the view of the Maromi Prat. The Maromi Prat is troubled by the Gemara. The Gemara states that on Chofei Kislev they drove the forces of Antiochus out of the Migdash, etc. Then they found the Parshem and they lit it. It burned for the 8 days. It says, Lishona, the next year they enacted the Yontif of Hanukkah. So he asks a very simple question. What did they wait an entire year for? If they won a victory in the war, so that's the time to celebrate. What do we have to wait a whole year later to start? If you win the war, you celebrate. As I told my Talmidim this year, it says, when the Yankees won the World Series, when did they celebrate? Next year? Right away. That's it. That week is the celebration. So what did they wait for an entire year? And so the Maromi Prat writes the following, that initially they did not realize the miraculous nature of the military victory. Everything did siyata d'shmaya, but that it was miraculous, this they did not realize until such time as they saw the Ness of the Menorah. When they saw the Ness of the Menorah, then they said, there are miraculous events taking place. If it's a time of miracles, let's re-examine the nature of the military victory which took place. And only then did they first discover that this was a miraculous victory.
It wasn't so lopsided, the military victory.
So the question is a very obvious question. If we read the Al-Anisim, there are two indices by which we measure the strength of an army. One is quantitative. You can have very good troops and very good equipment, but you have 1,000 soldiers. And you're fighting China, which on an off day puts 50 million people on the battlefield. So it's not going to help you, whatever you have going for you. That's one measure. A second measure is the quality of the troops that you have. What's their motivation, their morale, their armaments, their training, their leadership? That's the second index. Now, usually in history, if you have both advantages on your side, you usually win the war. And if you have one advantage on your side, you may win, you may lose. And here, the Al-Anisim tells us that in both indices, we were decidedly inferior to the forces of Antiochus. They were Rabin and we were Ma'atim. They had numerical superiority on the battlefield. And beyond that, Giborim Yad Chaloshim. They were powerful. They were well-trained, well-armed, well-led, well-disciplined. So from the qualitative standpoint, they had qualitative superiority as well. Now, with both of those aspects on their side, one would expect them to win the war handily, and yet they lost. So should we not realize the miraculous nature of the warfare just from the simple facts on the ground? That's the question. The answer to that question lies in the fact, in the nature of how we live in this world. We live in this world with an awareness that everything comes from the Rabbeinu Shalom. There's nothing that we can do other than which the Rabbeinu Shalom allows us to do. But despite the fact that we recognize, as the Ramban writes in Bo, the miraculous nature of everything in this world at some level, But we live in a world where we act according to the laws of nature. Does a farmer plant in the fall or plant in the spring? The answer is he plants in the spring. Why? It's the time that he's most likely going to succeed. In most years, that's the successful formula. The earth is correct, the nutrients are correct, the rain is correct, the sun is correct, and it works. Some years, it doesn't work. Come to the Catskills a few years ago, and the corn crop is a total disaster. I speak to a farmer, he says, I buried money here, that's it. Nothing grew. Didn't have the right amount of rain, it just shriveled. Well, it could rain too much, yeah. Rot the crops. It didn't rain enough. The crops just shriveled. Put $9,000 down, he told me, to plow the field and put all the grain down. And nothing. Normally he takes out about $20,000 profit from it. Nothing. Total wipeout. Now sometimes you plant in cheshvan and you'll succeed. So the weather stays warm, the rain is right. So it works. But you don't live such a way. We live according to the normal expectations of this world, and that's what we do. And everything that we do. And that's what the Rabbeinu Shalom wants us to do. Since we are not fatalistic, we believe that the human has responsibility to do in this world. So we have to act within the laws of nature. And because of that, we have a mindset that we view everything in terms of the natural order of the world. Because we have, that's the level that we have to live with. In and operate on. And therefore, anything that takes place, we define it as long as we possibly can within the laws of nature itself. And we can come to the conclusion that it was a mighty army of superior size, superior armament, leadership, but it lost in the battlefield. Why did it lose? Maybe the rebels had better motivation, they knew the topography better, they had more sympathy of the local people, whatever. All the reasons we may define that they won the war. But we try as much as possible to see everything in the world, b'derech hateva, because we operate in the realm of Tama. That's where we operate. And we need something at times to shock us, to raise our sights. When we, the nace of the menorah, we couldn't explain away. This was totally off the charts. Once we realized the truly miraculous nature of the menorah, then we began to contemplate that which took place in the war. And therein we saw the hand of the Rabbeinu Shalom as well. The very special and powerful hand of the Rabbeinu Shalom. But until then, it looked like another day's business. Of course, everything needs siyata d'shmaya, but nothing unusual happened today. I got on the bus, I went to work, I did my job, I came home, and that's it. You know, of course you need siyata d'shmaya.
Well, I didn't go that far. Obviously it was unusual. You just said it wasn't a miracle. I mean,
so,
it was normal,
one moment. It's not miraculous. It does not demand the chag. It does not demand the chag.
Isn't that two questions, though? I mean, there are miracles
in the Beis Hamikdash. That doesn't demand nothing. It was a hatzolah, but it was not, nothing miraculous took place. It does not demand the chag. Chag is to sing the Rabbeinu Shel Rabbeinu Shel did nisim l'mayda m'derech hateva.
But that is Lamayda Midarach HaTeva, if you are not clearly inferior in
both. It's not Lamayda Midarach. Within Teva it can take place too. It has a place in Teva too.
The question, was it a miracle, or is it a miracle that we have a chag? It seems like there's two questions. Right. There's two questions. Is something a miracle, however we understand that question? Or is it a miracle that we have a chag for?
It seems they did not appreciate the really miraculous nature of the events.
It was a miracle. They just didn't realize it.
Yes, correct. Yes.
Well, the way you said it, you know, like
50
of us.
You know, but in life we don't realize too readily.
Were there follow-up miracles in that year period for Chazal?
No, does not seem. I would think that the reason is once they truly comprehended the miraculous nature of the events, then the day of the they achieved the victory became a day to celebrate that ness. But it's very difficult to integrate. Hanukkah is to see the hand of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam when it's veiled. The veiled hand of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam was not hand that was not so obvious. In the events of Purim, it will be even more hidden than in the events of Hanukkah. And perhaps the reason for that is that this took place on Admas HaKodesh in Eretz Yisrael, and that's in Chutz La'aretz. Maybe that's part of the reason for it. But to see beyond the superficial, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam's hand lurks in history, and to see it. And that's a sensitivity that's not only for the events which took place in Hanukkah, but it's to make us sensitive to Yad Hashem in our own lives and everything that takes place. As the Ramban writes in Parshas Bo, the point of understanding the miraculous nature of events, the Lumayla Miderach HaTeva, is to understand the Rabbeinu Shel Olam's hand as we get closer and closer to Teva and to Teva itself. And therein lies a very fundamental point in Yahadus. The world asks the question, one of my Talmidim asked me the question today, but it's a very simple philosophical question. If a person's a maimon, he's a maimon. If he's not a maimon, he's not a maimon. If I see the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I approve, then I see it. If I don't see it, I don't see it. So what's there to do about it? And some even define the fact that that's perhaps the Ramban's question on the Rambam, how can you consider Amunah Mitzvah. Mitzvah is something that I have to do. Amunah is something, either I have it or I don't have it. How could you command me to have Amunah? That's a question I don't want to go into today. They're very nice answers to it. They're very important answers. So the answer lies in Chumash. At the end of Parshas Vayechi, we have the death of Yaakov Avinu. Now, this was a very frightening moment for Yosef's brothers. They were concerned that Yosef was an adherent of his uncle Esau's shittas. Yikrvu yimei evil of, heaven forfend that I cause anguish to my father. I worship the ground that he walks on. But once my father will no longer be affected by it, my enemies are my enemies, and if my enemies are my own brothers, it makes no difference. That's time to settle the score. So they were very, very frightened upon the death of Yaakov Avinu, and here they are in a situation where they're totally dependent on Yosef. It's not even that there's an even playing field, but they're totally dependent on him. He's a king, he's the one that feeds them. He has armies, he has wealth, a whole country behind them. Where are they? So they come and they tell him, "Hinenu l'chol avodim, we'll be your servants." And Yosef realizes what's taking place. He tells them, "Hasachas elokim anochi, do I stand in the place of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam?" The next pasuk says, "Atem chashavtem alai l'ra, you conspired against me to destroy me. Elokim chashavu l'tayva, but the Rabbeinu Shel Olam turned things in a fashion that brought great good to me, and not only to me, but for you as well. L'hach yei samrav, that I am the one that sustains you now. Rather than you doing me in with what you did, to the contrary, not only did I become great, but you sustained yourself by what you did." So Rashi says, "Hasachas Elokim Anoch is between." He says, "If I wanted to harm you, could I? Am I the Rabbeinu Shel Olam himself?" So this is fundamental in the Yud Gimel Ikrim of the Rambam. that everything that takes place in the world stems solely from the hands of the Rabbeinu Shalom. There's nobody in the world that could do anything. The Rabbeinu Shalom himself is the only one that can actually do anything. Who boyri amarig l'chol abruin, who levadoi oso v'yose v'yase l'chol amasa. The first of the Yudgim of the Kroon. The sole source of everything happening in this world is the Rabbeinu Shalom. He's the only doer. We are all marionettes. So Yosef tells them, what are you concerned about? Can anything, can I do anything to you? A person of Amunah, of deep Amunah, is not frightened.
Even a person of deep Amunah, you shouldn't be walking around with big steps.
Now listen, but that's, the question is, you don't place yourself in danger.
Right.
But if you wound, if you wound up in danger, you go in the hands of the Rabbi Shalala.
But you
can
take the logic and say Hashem's in charge of everything.
That's the Rabbi Shalala commanded us to do what we can to protect ourselves. So I will tell you, my Shrez of the Zangazan is the Talmud of Chatzko Levenstein. Chatzko Levenstein did not know what the word fear meant of anything in this world. The bombs flew. It was unfazed. And I tell people there's a tremendous incident that happened. Near the end of the war, the Americans were bombing the Japanese in Shanghai. And it was Zion Ob, if I recall correctly. It was Ben Osmanim. And my Shver had spent a day or two relaxing in his, rooms. And then he decided that day he's going to go to yeshiva. The building that he lived in was destroyed. And his roommate survived b'derech nes, mamash b'derech nes. The building was hit by a bomb and caved in. And my Shver was in the Beis Medrash, and the bombs were flying. So he was looking, for a cellar to run into, for protection. And Rav Chatzkel Levenstein was totally unfazed. And Rav Chatzkel said to him, he says, what do you think? That you're going to become exempt from this world so quickly? He says, you have a great deal of Avodas Hashem to do before you leave. And he was not joking. He was not a letz. He was absolutely serious. He was unfazed. He wasn't running any place. He was unfazed. So Yosef told him, everything stems from the Rabbeinu Shalom. Fine. So that's, if you feel a person is somewhat frightened and lacking at the moment and understanding the Yud Gimel Ikra, okay. So that's what he told him. But what's the next pasuk mean? Atem chashavtem alai ruleru. So Rashi says, well, consider what took place. When 10 of you conspired against me, what's the likelihood of your success? Very great. And what happened? Exactly the opposite of what you planned is what came forth. So what's the likelihood that one person is going to succeed against 10? Now, it's enough, more than enough, that Yosef chides them about the Yud Gimel Ikra. But then Yosef goes to prove it to them too. Has to prove it to them, they didn't believe it. The answer is, as Rabbi Saul Salanta said, that there are many things that we know in the head, but there's a very lengthy road from the mind to the heart. And very difficult to traverse. What Yosef was telling them is, how does a person integrate Amunah into his emotional makeup? That they react to the world in terms of Amunah, not only in terms of the knowledge of Amunah, but in the feeling of Amunah. Says the ultimate means is to study our own lives. Says, what's the most critical decision that you made in your entire lives? Right? For Yosef's brothers, what was the most critical decision? Chiras Yosef, right? This was the gravest decision that they made in their life. And it happens to be they made it incorrectly too. But a very grave decision. And so examine the most critical moment in your own lives. What was your intention and what took place? And if you understand that, then you will understand the entire world. So much of what takes place in this world is inexplicable in terms of the normal expectations of the situation. And I always tell people that you should play a little game with yourself. And you'll establish this. First, write the story of your life in terms of where you were born, where you live, your family, your circumstances. And from that standpoint, write the story of what you would expect your life to be. From 1 until the age of 60. Then, after you didn't do that, now start the story again. Write what actually happened. And very, very often in life, and maybe all the time in life, the person winds up in a very different place than he would have expected in terms of where he started off. Why? Well, we put in quotes the chance meetings of life. He went to a certain place, he met a certain person, he went to a certain school, he did this opportunity opened up, and he went, his life developed in directions that he could not foresee. And once, after I told people to do this, an elderly person that I know for many, many years came to me and he says, "Rabbi, you're absolutely right. You just told the story of my life tonight." And he tells me, just to give a stark example of it, he tells me the following story. He says, "I was a teenager, 16, 17 years old, and my parents, he's a man in his 80s today. So a story about 70 years ago this happened. Since my parents decided to move off, he had from parents, they decided to move off to suburbia. He says, I had no intention of going off to suburbia. Why, he said? I just wanted to go to school here, and I was making money here in those years. I had varied jobs, so I had no intention to go off to suburbia and just leave that all behind me. But my parents went, so I had to decide, what am I going to do? Where am I going to stay? She says, so I heard that Yeshiva Chaim Berlin has a dormitory. So he says, I went to Rav Huttner Zatzal, and I told him that I want to join the yeshiva. So Rav Huttner was a rather astute individual. He sizes him up. He says, Beryl, that's not his name, but Beryl. He says, what do you want to join the yeshiva? What do you want here? So Beryl was a straightforward guy. So Beryl tells him, listen, I'll tell you. My parents move off to suburbia, I have a dormitory, I need a roof over my head. So I wouldn't say that's fine. He says, you can come to yeshiva anyhow. He says, then I told Rav Huttner, listen, on Sunday afternoons I'm not going to be in yeshiva. He says, why? He says, because Sunday afternoons I work in a caterer. Okay. Now, the weekday afternoons I'm also going to be gone for a while because I'm teaching the Talmud Torah. Fine to that too. He says, in the summers I work in a camp. That's also fine. He says, but there's one condition that I have for Putnam's itself told me. And that is, for 1 hour a day, you have to hire one of the Choshev Bochum and Yeshiva to learn with you. So he said, I did. That was the Roshiva's condition. I live up to it. I think the one he was later a Magid Shir in Chaim Berlin, and he used to pop Yeshiva of Levenberg. That's how, whatever I remember of. So he says, I hired him, I paid him to learn with me an hour a day. He says, and that changed my entire life. That's what happened. He says, I was in the yeshiva for a while. And then one fine day, Rav Huttner decided that he wants to open up Camp Mars. So he calls me in, and he says, listen, you told me once that you're involved with summer camps. So I said, yeah. He says, then I want you to go up to the mountains and set up the summer camp for me. Okay, so he says, I went up to the mountains and I set up Camp Morris, Chaim Berlin. While I was in camp up in the mountains, I met a girl who lived in Monticello, and I married her. 6 years later, I'm still married to her. He says, my entire life took place from what you would say chance encounters, unusual things that took place, wrote the story of my life. And that's what we need to see in Hanukkah. What we need to see in Hanukkah is to pull away the veils that surround everything that's taken place in our life, and to see the hands of the Rabbeinu Shalom. How it is that I am where I am now, that very things in my life are ordered in the way that they are, and to realize that this is all Yad Hashem, and to see it very clearly. I had an incident about 2 weeks ago. I was trying to do a chesed with someone in Eretz Yisrael. And they needed a consultation with a doctor. And it happened to be that I know a doctor in the northeastern United States that was exactly what he needed, what this person needed. So I didn't have his number, but I endeavored Erev Shabbos. I got his number. It was too late to call him before Shabbos. After Shabbos, I make inquiry about his whereabouts. So I found out that after Shabbos, he's going to Eretz Yisrael. He wasn't planning to go to Eretz Yisrael, but something occurred, and he has to go to Eretz Yisrael for a few days. So the consultation took place in the house of the person who needed the services. The doctor was a very, very fine man, and he went to visit the person in Eretz Yisrael who needed his help, and told him his day. So I said, here I was just that. I was trying to shatchan these two people because one could help the other. Good. He'd send them his files, he'd speak to him, he'd ask him for information. And what did the Rabbi Shalom? He's thinking small, you know. I do things at a big scale. And the Rabbi Shalom took him. Here I was Friday, tracking him down. But I think by Sunday night he was on the way to Eretz Yisrael already. By Monday he was in Eretz Yisrael. And by Tuesday or Wednesday I went to see the person that I wanted to consult with him. I'm just stunned. I'm just watching this take place. I mean, if I endeavor in every way I could in the world, you know, if I were Michael Bloomberg, yeah, I guess I could afford, you know, I'd be able to call the doctor and tell him I'll give him $100,000 to go to Eretz Yisrael to help this person out. You know, he probably would go. I'm not even sure of that. But, you know, but here, the Rabbeinu Shalom does wondrous things. But we need to take that step back to see them. That's what Hanukkah, that's the message of Hanukkah. So that's what we spend 8 days of Hanukkah for. Yeah. Hanukkah has mitzvahs too. Varied mitzvahs. The hadlaka being the principal one, but not the only mitzvah of Hanukkah. The halal and hador being no less significant than the hadlaka. Now, we want to talk about some of the situations, the difficult situations that we have, which arise in Hanukkah. And that is, if a person is traveling in Hanukkah, with a light. Now, I mean, suppose, for example, that tonight would be the first night of Hanukkah. And at 2 o'clock this afternoon, I had to go to the airport to catch a flight. And by the time I get off the flight, the night's gone. So where should I light?
On the plane.
Yeah, I guess. One thing's for sure, if you want to have a lot of time in your life to learn, light on the plane. You'll have a lot of time to learn. You know, in today's world, you know, once upon a time maybe they would have put you into the looting bin, but today, in today's world, you'll have a lot of time to learn if you try such a thing.
The Ethiopians, when they wanted to take them to Israel, they never seen a plane before. And one of them wanted to light a fire in the middle to cook a meal.
No, he actually did. That's what it was. They brought to the pilot, they brought him some hot coffee during the flight. And he said, there's no galley aboard. How do they have hot coffee? He ran back and they had a fire in the...
Well, they did.
It's a true story.
It was like a wet stove or something.
So what do you do? Now, this, we can divide this up into a number of, into a few different possibilities. Number one is if someone from your family is home. So we have aloha, nerishu beisa. In bottom line, not every person is, despite the fact that there's a minhag that everyone likes, but it's not obligatory. I'm yaitzi the din, even if I don't light myself. If I intend to be yaitzi with someone else in the house, and they intend to light for me, that's enough.
Who's saying the bracha? Is she saying the bracha for me?
The person that's lighting is saying the bracha,
so
yeah.
I don't have to say any bracha, she did it.
Well, listen, I'm not there, what can I do? It's obviously one should endeavor to hear the brachas and say amen, but what can I do? It's a time that I had luck at 5 o'clock, I'm on over the Atlantic Ocean someplace.
Okay.
You know, so what am I going to do? So that's the simple answer to this problem. What gets more complex is what happens if you're in two parts of the world. This, I first tuned in on this shayla many years ago. A chaver of mine called me. Says, my wife is already going to be in Eretz Yisrael before Hanukkah. And I'm going to join her on Hanukkah.
She's
ahead of it. So now, how's she going to light for him? Right? When she is hard, they just take the first day of Hanukkah. That's the starkest example.
7 hours later.
Right? She's in Hanukkah. For me, it's Erev Hanukkah. So right. How am I going to, on Erev Hanukkah, I'm going to be yaitzi in the Daenerys of the first night? Very difficult notion. So I told him I wasn't happy with any of the solutions that he had, that he couldn't travel late enough when he had to travel. He wouldn't be home the day that he traveled. So we decided to reorder his trip, whatever, and make it work differently, that he should get around this problem. Now, there is a stunning chiddush of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and I come back to it each year Hanukkah, and I'm no closer to integrating it than the first time that I saw it. Integrating the lumdus that's behind it. Rosh Shlomo Zalman, Zatzal, writes that Neris Hanukkah is Neri Yishu Beis. If they lit in my house, I'm Yaitse. I am in America, there. It's irrelevant. Neris Hanukkah will lit in my house, that's enough. It's a very hard notion to understand. My assumption, especially being that it's not the house that has the obligation to light. It's my personal chiyuv. The place of lighting is the house. It's the family lights collectively, but it's not a din and a bias. That's what he seems to be suggesting. I mean, the world has a Shiloh, which I saw really addressed in a tshuva, I think by a Pfeffer, or by a Rav Pfeffer, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, I don't remember. A Rav that lived probably in America 70, 80 years back, something like that, if I recall correctly. That Chometz on Pesach, so does it follow the person or the place? In other words, if I'm in the United States and I have Chometz in Eretz Yisrael, so when do I have to be rid of that Chometz? When it becomes Pesach in Eretz Yisrael, or when it becomes Pesach in America? That's his Shiloh. Now, to me, the pashtus of the Shiloh always was that there's no din in the Chometz. All the dinim of Pesach apply to me. I cannot own Chometz on Pesach. If for me it's Erev Pesach, then how can I can be sitting eating a roll now, so how can you tell me I can't own Chometz in Eretz Yisrael? What's the difference? I'm allowed to eat Chometz now, so what's the problem? So I found subsequently that Rav Moshe Zatzal also took that stance. But Rav Moshe had a very interesting chiddush. Rav Moshe said there's a second din derabbanan that you should not have chametz in a place where it is Pesach already, despite the fact it won't be over by your roll. But you're not supposed to have chametz. I guess you're supposed to be like all the rest of the Jews in that place and not to have chametz in that place anymore. So if Rosh Shlomo Zalman perhaps is suggesting it's a din, that the bias has to have Neres Chanukah, that's the din. It's not really Tully and me. Somebody has to light it. So, it's me, someone else. It just can't come by itself. You know, needs the human input to be a Maisa Mitzvah. But the point is that the bias should have Neres Chanukah. Perhaps that's what he's suggesting. It's a phenomenal chiddush.
Remember that case you mentioned with a wife already in Eretz Israel?
Yeah, yes.
So
that's a phenomenal, that's what he holds. It's a phenomenal.
But also the wife could wait till 12 midnight to light Eretz Israel and then it would be 5 o'clock here.
It's not so simple either. It's not so simple either because of the fact that maybe in Eretz Israel you have to light Bismarck. That's a whole issue. I mean, I'm very, very cautious. I am very, very cautious. And in Eretz Israel, I never lit late the years that I was there, Hanukkah. It's very makbet to always light Bismarck. Because I personally think that the heterum that we have to light late are rooted in the fact that our ikachia was to light indoors. And therefore, there's no longer the public dimension of Prasumanisa. The Prasumanisa is now for the people that are inside. So inside is totally the people that are inside. But in Lechayr and Eretz Yisrael, it has to be the earlier din of the Gemara comes back. You light for people outside. You light for people outside. So then the din is you have to light Misha Tishkacham. And those Rishonim, the Riyaz, for example, that hold that you can't light after half an hour. So Lechayr and Eretz Yisrael, according to them, you can't light after half an hour. And the Rajba allows you to light after half an hour. So like it's Rishonim. So I was always very, very makbid in Eretz Yisrael to light Bismarck.
How did anyone, and you can't daven
Mincha and
Maariv together, you have to be home till
light.
What do they do?
Daven
Maariv and run home? Or
yeah, listen, one time I came, I lit Mamish like 2-3 minutes before the half an hour. Because I was at the Kaisel, I came back from the Kaisel, but we raced home. I came in a few minutes before the half an hour. So I'm not so sure, Eretz Yisrael, it's a good idea to wait late to light. Now, there's another possibility that one has. It's a chiddushic idea to me as well. And it's, I think, easier than, I believe easier than the to me than the idea that Rav Shlomo Zalman suggested. And I once heard Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky Shlit articulate this idea that I could have a shliach go to my house and light in my house. Point a shliach to light for me. So I'll take my oil and my manure and my house and a light.
It makes a bracha for you.
That's a fear. The truth is, we pass, and if you're a shliach for someone else for a maisa mitzvah, you can make a bracha.
As we said, the wife
is. Let's say your wife is not there.
The wife is not there?
Nobody's there.
Nobody's there?
Yeah. You're on the plane and your wife is in Israel. Nobody either.
You don't light it.
Okay.
That's it.
So I'm not necessarily. I'm not telling you necessarily. Okay. I'm not necessarily telling you that someone should make a brocha. I still think there's a chiddush in this idea.
Or you do it, or you don't. That's my
idea. I still think that there's a chiddush in the idea. So I would not, even though normally a shliach can make a mitzvah. On a mitzvah that he does
for someone else.
In this case, I'm not convinced that you should be making the brocha. Now, what are not solutions? I mean, is the light in the airport, for example. I don't believe it works.
Oh no.
No. Listen, I don't. There are only two places in the world that you can light. You can light in your house. If it's not your house, you cannot light there. Taz is very clear about that. Okay. The second place you can light is in a Beis HaKnesses.
Okay.
If you're in neither of those two when you make a brocha, it's a brocha levatol. Yes. Example. Yes, though it's your house temporarily.
Temporary house.
Yeah.
If they keep you overnight at
the
airport,
you have a problem. Go rent yourself a hotel room. You're sitting on a couch in the airport lounge. It's not your room.
Chapel, that's a shul.
You're not yoitzi there.
Or where you eat? Right?
What kind of shul are
there? A shul. You're not yoitzi with the neiros and shul.
Oh, the shul.
What about where you eat?
It has to be where you eat. Has to be a place that is your house to eat.
Oh, okay.
That's what the Taz writes. You go to a restaurant, you eat in there, you can't light there.
If you were to like sleep in the like the Shul Chapel.
Listen, nobody authorized you to sleep there.
If they did.
If they had the right, so maybe it could be a house for the night.
It used to be a
place. So these are some of the common issues that arise that make it very, very difficult, you know, for a person to light.
So what happens if a person doesn't yotze?
So what happens if one didn't wear tefillin today? He's also not yotze.
So
that's it. So one has to look to be yotze. It's easy not to be yotze in this world. The question is to find a way to be yotze. That's the issue.
So the point is, you can't take being an airplane that day.
It's not a very good thing to do, but not everyone has the choice. But it's far better if one is Mekayim Ashrei Yesh
V'Yaseicha. Could you do the electric light thing on the airplane? I mean, you're sort of...
The electric light is a very, you know, controversial story. You know, if you had nothing else to do... If you had nothing else to do, I would tell you to take a flashlight and put it on. And try to be yotze with that. And a flashlight is your best possibility, assuming that it is a real bulb, not an LED. With electricity is your best possibility of being yotze. Why? The halacha states the following.
Are you yotze
with
that? You're not yotze with electricity.
There's a great deal of controversy about it. And one obvious problem with the electric is we say hadlocha is a mitzvah. That means that everything has to be in place at the moment of the hadlocha. Now, suppose I put a little bit of oil in and I light, and I come back every 5 minutes and I add some more oil, and I keep the thing burning for half an hour. I'm not yotze, because hadlocha is a mitzvah. Now, in electricity, say there was a tshuva written by someone on Eretz Yisrael, and it was misunderstood by others. I believe that read the tshuva subsequently, they did not catch his point. He said, if the power station goes down, the Hanukkah neros will go off. So they said, listen, that must have been in those times someone wrote, you know, the power stations went down. How often does it happen there? Fortunately, it doesn't happen. But I think they missed the point. I think the point of the tshuva was, if the power station goes down and the light goes off, it's a simon that you don't have a half an hour's worth of fuel here. He's pumping new fuel in constantly. That's what I think the point of that tshuva is. And therefore, it doesn't fit the requirement of hadlocha is a mitzvah. Whereas that's what I'm telling you, if you had to use an electric light, I certainly wouldn't make a brocha for Neres Chanukah. But if you use the flashlight, where you have the battery, so then you don't have this problem, because you have all the fuel is here already.
I'm not sure, because if a power station, let's say you have either a nuclear reactor or you have... Some of them are powered by gas, so they have the...
But the question is, I don't have the power presently. It means I'm getting a new infusion of them constantly.
Oh,
what happens?
Why is it not just like a long pipe? That's where the fuel comes from.
It's not, you see it's not a long pipe, because what happens if the power station goes down?
Well, pipes can break, but that's not your...
It doesn't come. So it doesn't, it's being generated constantly. It's different than having fuel. Fuel in your tank and your car is there. Fuel from a power station is being pumped to you constantly. You know, it's being delivered constantly.
It's
not manufactured.
It's the voltage, the pressure of the electrons.
Yeah. So that's being delivered to you. That's not there at the moment.
It's
I don't
know.
Okay, everybody, so that's enough for tonight.